You're listening to the Sports Therapy Association podcast. Let's talk about.
How are you doing, people? Welcome. Welcome to Sports Therapy Association podcast, as now it's officially going to be called. How exciting, how wonderful. Episode 26. I mean, it made sense, didn't it? We had 25 episodes there, fantastic episodes, which I think myself included and all you lovely people who join us live take for granted, because they go on to therapy, therapistlearning.com. And then also somebody the other day, Evie from Physio Online, after the Physio Bill chat last week, said, oh, I can't wait, this comes out as a podcast. Ding, of course. So you will see that it is now officially a podcast, Sports Therapy Association podcast. And it's fantastic. It's given me a reason to actually look back and listen to them. I listened to the one with Jack Chu, which was episode 2, I think, about imposter syndrome. And honestly, not a word of a lie, I thought I'd just check the sound and quality. I listened to the whole thing all the way beginning to end. It was brilliant, if I say so myself. It was really, really nice. It was really personal. And also it was, because it was back when the first lockdown was happening, it was really interesting. It was a real jump through time, which now we're back in. So anyway, it is live. You can find it on all your podcast players. It's on Apple Podcasts now and iTunes. So before I forget, another thing for the Sports Therapy Association Army to do is go to iTunes if you're Android, give it a rating, give it a review. If you're on iPhones, it's simple. All you need to do is go into your iPhone app and then you'll get a chance. Find Sports Therapy Association Podcast. Leave a rating, leave a review. I need 50 of them by tomorrow, please, because that's the way they start. It's the podcasts get selected by Google and Apple and they raise the ranks and appear in search results. Excuse me. So, yeah, do please take a minute out of your busy days to leave a rating and a review. There we go. That was the most important thing today, apart from the guest this week, who is Andrew Caldwell. I'm very excited. I've just had a little chat with him. I don't know anybody else who's done more in their lives in so many angles and so many. I mean, I'm not even going to mention half of them because we'll just be here all night, seriously. But it fitted in perfectly with the topic that we're going to bring to you tonight, which is that kind of working with recreational, non-competitive population and then working with the more serious competitive, even elite athletes as well. What are the similarities? What are some of the differences? How's it been affected by COVID-19? Do you have to adjust your marketing, your relationship building, your virtual consultations? And I'm so glad Andrew said yes to this because he can do it. I couldn't, and we'll talk about that. But he definitely has and continues to dip into popular sporting, non-sporting the whole time. So before I bring Andrew up, just say hi to people here. If you're new to the show, then if you leave a comment and I put it on the screen, then it's lovely. Your name appears and your photo appears. If you're listening to the podcast, then thank you. What you're listening to is a bunch of us who are actually recording this live in the room, commenting, discussing. It's not all Sports Therapy Association members. Non-members are welcome to come. You don't even have to be a sports therapist. You could just be just, that's a horrible word. You can be any form of soft tissue therapist, physios, osteos, chiros, massage therapists. Anybody is welcome because it's all the healthcare industry. Okay. And anybody who's moving in the right direction is realizing that. So, hey, Mark, how you doing? Thanks for joining us. Becky's in the house as well. Thank you, Becky. Tom is here. That's fantastic. I mean, thanks to the wall from Tom. You'll notice that we're updating our stuff thanks to Tom Caldwell, making it a little more crisp and white and clean. So look at our YouTube channel, for example. I've changed that about a little bit based on a la Tom. And I think it's looking really nice. Namir, how you doing, mate? Thanks for turning up. Timothy, evening. Don't worry, mate. We're still going through the ramblings before we actually bring the important man on. Kevin, how you doing? That's a metaphor, Tom. I can't remember what I said now. Or Isla Tom. Don't know. Looking forward to this one. Says M, thanks for joining us. Sarah, thank you very much as well. Nice to see a few of you as well appearing in Runners Collective. I'm waiting to 1,000 members before we start doing regular chats, regular web chats on that. I think we're up to about 600 now. So if you haven't checked out Runners Collective, then I'll mention it a little bit at the end. But anyway, good to see you all, guys. You make the evening. It's still, we are famous for getting the most live listeners out of anything I know. All of these live lunchtime things popping up all over the place. We get the most, guys. We've already got 26 and we haven't even brought the guest in yet. So I really am proud to be part of this. And thank you for coming along every evening, pretty much every evening. Right. A quick mention for Bill, Physio Bill last week. It was amazing, wasn't it? It was great. Thank you for the feedback. Love it as always. Bill was talking about men's pelvic health, men's health, and him, particularly following on from Gronia last week, who was talking about women's health. The two of them showed how similar they are on many, many levels, apart from the obvious, but in terms of the functioning, the things that can go wrong, the questions, the taboos, very, very similar. Okay. And it was a great message. I encourage you. They're not down as the podcast yet. They're definitely on YouTube, her channel. So I would check them both out. Definitely. And like I say, podcast is there waiting for you to leave a great rating and a review, people. We need you again. We need your work. It's on there waiting for you. Right. Enough of that. I can now bring up the man himself. I'm hoping, again, some of you haven't met him, because if you haven't, prepare yourselves. He's done so much. I'm so excited to hear how he managed to do half the things he's done. But yeah, I'm going to bring up Andrew Caldwell, who, again, a physio, and we will have sports therapists here as well. But I really wanted someone who encompasses working with so many populations, and Andrew was the obvious guy. He's been involved in the NHS, so working with general population for 7 years. He's also been head physio in football clubs. He's worked with professional golf. He's worked in tennis. He's worked in MMA. So he's got a huge mixture there. So I'm really excited to bring him up. So that said and done, let's say hello to Andrew Caldwell. Hello, mate.
Evening. How are you doing? Okay?
Yes. Yeah, thank you for your patience. I had lots to get through.
The camera's still working, so that's all good.
So thanks for joining us, mate. Really kind of you.
No problem at all. Pleasure to be here, Matt. Great to catch up with you as well.
Yeah, nice to see. We haven't seen each other for a long time. I think first time, I can't remember. I think the first time might have been Therapy Expo, one, the first or second
it was,
one.
Yeah, I think it was a running course down in London with James and Brad.
Was that the first one? Right,
yeah, we had lunch together and we chewed the fat over a bit of MMA, actually. So
that was the first one. So that would have been probably before Therapy Expo, I think, maybe. Yeah, that was good. Yeah, with James and Brad.
Yeah, great course. Great couple of guys as well.
But you've done some work as well, I think, because you've worked with the running clinic as well.
Yeah. So I'm one of the lecturers for the running clinic. We've just not run any education in the UK in a little while now. JF's obviously diversified that all over the world, really. JF Esculier, and he's such a great guy, you know, unbelievably knowledgeable. Obviously, you've had him at your running conference, done a ton of great research, but such a good teacher as well, and just absolute knowledge base with regard to anything running-related injuries. He's unbelievable. So it's great for me to learn from Jeff, actually. So
he's great. We had in Run Chat Live conference the other day, the online one, we had for one of the lunchtime drop-ins, we had JF, who was on a treadmill for the 2-hour session, the lunch session, just walking away, talking as he does, looking cool and French. But then we also had Greg in, who's obviously done some work. Greg Lehman came in and he was the total opposite. He was just laying back. He'd just woken up. He was locked in a room away from the kids. It couldn't be more laid back. And then also we had Kevin Maggs, who's the division, the USA division of running clinic. And the three of them was like looking at something out of like Christmas Carol or something. It was like the past, present and future or something of the running clinic. But you can imagine the stuff that came out of the mouth was good. Was very good.
Absolute gold, I'm sure.
Right. So mustn't get all running. I've got to take my running hat off for tonight. So people, we're going to be talking about differences between working with sporting population and non-sporting population. Obviously there'll be a COVID twist to it as well, so I'm interested in anybody who's listening to talk about, have you found virtual works, doesn't work, what changes have you had to make, and that sort of stuff. Whilst we're doing that, whilst you're thinking of questions, people, which you can chuck in the comments, tell us a little bit about yourself, Andrew, and how you, what order did it come in? Did you work with the non-sporting population first, or did you naturally drift into the sporting population, or how did your career take off?
I've been a physio 23 years this year. So initially it all started from an interest in sport. I was a bang average rugby player, but playing in a very good team. Four of my teammates went on to play Super League, Rugby League. So we had a pretty handy school side and subsequently went on to be more and more involved in sport. It was a major theme in my life, really. So by the time I got to physiotherapy training, I always knew that that's the direction that I wanted to head in. But initially, my career started at Queen's Medical Centre in Nottingham, looking at the junior rotations there. And that was just such a fantastic place to start your career. It's a huge hospital, lots of different areas to work in, from orthopaedics to neuro. I think that's what where you develop your patient skills a lot of the time, just in terms of interacting with people, communication, assessment. Did that for 18 months, probably 2 years actually. And then started to realize that musculoskeletal was more my calling. So got a senior two post as it was then in MSK. And then from there, started to work privately, again, within sport, started to work within a clinic that was offering some fairly specialized biomechanical assessment at the time. So we had clients from various football clubs, cricket clubs, and other bits and bobs come in as specialist consultancy work, really. And I was learning from some two really experienced people. And this has been a bit of a common thread of mine through my career, I suppose, that like many, you learn from some really key people across your career. And I've been fortunate. I suppose I've been partly fortunate, but I do say this to people when they ask advice about how to get where they want to be and maybe a career in sports physiotherapy. You have to look for opportunities. And if you don't seek to look for those opportunities, they aren't going to land on your lap. So you've got to put yourself out there and be in the right time at the right place. And it's a combination of all of that coming together. So I moved from that private clinic to work at Loughborough University for 7 years with the elite athletes. And that's where I was working with the women's FA development squad. Some of our girls went on to play for the full England senior, and one now is a commentator on BT Sport, Kaz Carney. So she was one of our players back then. Started to look at working with the tennis players at that point as well. So myself and Matt Little, who's now Andy Murray's fitness guy, were working together there at the LTA Regional Centre. And that was a fantastic grounding because we were setting up a service there that wasn't there before and developing that. And we were very much learning on our feet. And I talked with Matt in one of my podcast episodes, and we were chatting about our experiences as much as tennis, you know, which was a learning experience for us as much as anything. And then from there, went on to work in professional football as head of sports medicine at Hart. Was up there for 3 years. Unfortunately, we won the Scottish Cup. I was up there. So that was an unbelievably good experience. Opened up bus ride and all the stuff through Edinburgh, which was absolutely phenomenal. And we had a really, really good squad there, which was a pleasure to work with. But that was a real challenge point in my career because I was heading up the service as well as being the first team physio as well. So it's a bit of a wearing two hats, you know, being the first team physio and also trying to run the service in the department, which was quite challenging at times. And then from there, came back into the NHS and decided to do my master's. Part of that was we were having my daughter at the time and working in football, you're not home that much. So I made a bit of a career sacrifice at that point, I suppose, that I wanted to spend more time at home. I wanted to see my kids grow up, and working in professional football, you just don't really get the opportunity to do that so much. So I took that opportunity to come back into the NHS, study for my master's, did injection therapy training as part of that, and a mentorship with an orthopaedic colleague who I still work with now. And then from there, then came and developed my own private practice. And from there, it's kind of moved on, really. So it's a bit of a meandering journey, but there's a bit of a common thread throughout it all. I like to think that, you know, I've tried to look for opportunities where they've existed, try to push myself, as you say, into different opportunities where they exist, and now try to help other people. Obviously, we've met through some of the teaching work that we do, and I always get great pleasure from the educational side of things and meeting people. And if you can impart some positive knowledge with them that helps them to be better in some way, then that's a fantastic feeling.
It's been a common theme whenever we had people up here talking about their lives. We had Keith Burnett, who's a fantastic story of somebody who came from very little education, followed the sports therapy line as opposed to physiotherapy, and found some locked doors and so a few kind of like dinosaurs saying you've got the wrong career, you're not gonna get in here sort of thing. And now he's, you know, working with England University's rugby teams and doing a PhD as well. in concussion and stuff, and really getting his name up there. So he's really proud. I'm wondering, I did have the question, why did you move back into the NHS? But you've answered that wonderfully. Couldn't be a nicer answer, could it, to be with my family, Matt? What a hero. Fantastic, good answer. Yeah. But I was also wondering as well, because it's interesting for us, you've been all the way through from Loughborough and obviously in the NHS, well, actually in the NHS as well. Have you seen sports therapists or the kind of people you've been working with, have you seen their reputation or their quality change from the beginning back in the day to where you are now, whether it be from football or in Loughborough and that sort of stuff?
Yeah, enormously. I think part of that is down to some of the higher standard of education that's going on now. Definitely. I think I've always been a massive supporter of sports therapists. I'm not, I know there's a professional snobbery sometimes that exists, and I don't really still understand why it does. I think part of that's the barriers coming up, you know, there's professional barriers sometimes where it's still maybe viewed that we all have to work in individual silos, and that's not necessarily true anymore. But I think the quality of education, the standard of competence of sports therapists has just gradually got better and better and better. I think back when I was at Hearts, it was there was a bit more of a focus on sports rehabilitators as well. So we were looking at bringing some sports rehabilitators in. And the only reason that really at that point that we couldn't have them involved on a more pitch side basis was purely for insurance purposes. And that was the only reason behind in the scenes, you know, day to day, Monday to Friday, we had sports therapists and sports rehabilitators working with the squad. And that's just got more and more prevalent, I think, as time's gone on. And I think, you know, where somebody chooses to specialise their career in sport as physiotherapists, we start generic and then we learn to specialise. I think when you've got, I think the key differentiator for me was I would have considered studying sports therapy myself had the recognition of the profession at that point been probably slightly more well understood, and there wasn't a few more gates maybe open for people at that point. That may well have been a path that I led myself down, because I was very clear from the outset of my career that that's where I wanted to head up. So for me, it would make a lot of sense for me to actually study sports therapy and go through that way. But I just don't think the opportunities existed when I was looking at the various options back then. Whereas now, I think clearly, and you know, Gary at the STA is really at the forefront of this as well, driving the profession forward and really trying to open doors and beat down barriers, because that needs to happen, really.
Yeah, I think I saw Gary actually tweeting today that as a profession, sometimes we have been guilty of not allowing our profession to get recognised by calling, he really hates people, sports therapists, calling themselves physios. Even if you're working for a football club, you know, just make it clear that you're not a physio, you're a sports therapist, but you're proud of it. And there's been a little bit of that in the past of like embarrassment or an imposter syndrome, like I mentioned, when we talk about with Jack Chu. But now hopefully sports therapists are standing out a bit more. I know this bunch in here are, and they're kind of shouting from the rooftops, I'm a sports therapist and I'm proud of it. And that's the only way, because then when you do 100%. Well, you know, so that's good. Yeah. So that's useful.
Yeah, 100% agree with that. And I think, you know, moving forward, I think that some of it's historical, isn't it, that just physiotherapy has been around for a lot more years, and where we're at with sports therapies, it's a relatively young profession still. So I think I've no doubt in my mind moving forward over the next few years that sports therapists will get equal and well-deserved recognition in line with all of the other health and fitness professionals, really. I mean, so it's already there in terms of what I think of the professional standard of sports therapists. It's just things like insurance companies and other bits and bobs and the extra recognition that we need for sports therapists to be working in the more mainstream areas, really.
I've got a question coming already, just marked on. I thought Tom's ears would pick up here when you mentioned it, and he has. He's taken the bait. Tom Colwell here has asked a question. Do you think there's a difference between sports rehab pros and strength and conditioning coaches in your experience? Have you come across either?
I think that it depends on, it all comes down to level of training, really. You know, people view me as a physiotherapist, but I probably do as much work with injury risk reduction, mitigation, strength and conditioning as I actually do with physiotherapy now. And that's because I've chosen to go down that route, extend my knowledge base, spend some time with S&C coaches, understand a lot more about strength and conditioning. I started my professional career probably in the first 10 years of my professional career, like many of my era. I qualified in 97, and back then the manual therapy bias was really quite strong. So lots of the Australian and New Zealand manual therapists were, you know, deemed to be the top physiotherapists in the world at that point, and very influential on everything we were seeing and doing, how we might treat patients. And then we started to see emergence of things like more biopsychosocial type of elements to treatment. And then it's quite ironic in many ways that physiotherapy used to be remedial therapists. That's where the profession has developed from. And we've probably come in the late 1990s and early 2000s so far away from that as a professional strength, more towards the manual treatment side of things. And now it's nice to see that many professions, including physiotherapists, osteopaths, chiropractors, sports therapists, and sports rehabilitators, probably always had that as their strength, all having exercise prescription strength and conditioning as a main backbone of what they're doing. So I think that's where we've got to probably move away from dropping labels and actually say, well, what's the professional competence or the experience of the therapist, whoever that is that you're working with, and what's their skill set to be able to help you try and resolve the issue, the problem, the condition, whatever it is we're dealing with effectively.
Great answer. I can imagine Tom's there nodding his head going, yeah, he didn't fall for it. I'm sure he is. I can imagine now. Okay, so let's get down to the topic then of kind of, you obviously worked with sporting to you know, very high level, and non-sporting as well. Most important question is, who's your favourite?
Oh, that's a slightly loaded question, Matthew. I think that they're both really challenging in different ways, I would say. They're very clearly different, you know, in lots of different ways. I think you can get just as much enjoyment. What people have is a perception that working with the elite sports person in some way is better than helping somebody with a weekend warrior who's got a knee problem and we need to get them back for their local cup final. That can be just as rewarding for them as it can for the elite person who's going to the World Championships or the Olympic Games in their world. So it's all about context, really. The context of the person that you're working with. My personal preference, just because it isn't something that I think is lesser or more in any way whatsoever, but I particularly enjoy the complexity and higher level of challenge that you have when you work with elite sports people, because of the demands that they place upon themselves and those around them. You see this probably best at somewhere like Loughborough. You just sense, I don't know whether you've ever been to Loughborough or any of the guys listening have, but there's just this performance environment that you're surrounded by all of the time. And what happens is, as a therapist or somebody working in that environment, it really pushes you on. It really encourages you to know more, do more, be better at what you do. And I think that's a positive thing. Now, the flip side of that would be when you're working with elite sports people, there's a level of pressure and expectation that comes with that. You know, these people are competing for lots of money or big championships, and there's that pressure of getting them to that next championship or getting them back safely and effectively. And there's just that little bit more pressure attached to get it right first time round, really. So personally, I enjoy that. Some people don't. That's why they maybe don't work in elite sport. But I get just as much enjoyment helping, you know, my 20 handicap golfer, help them win the club championship, and they come in and, you know, we have a kind of good laugh and joke about it. And I think it's just context, Matt. That's the main thing. You know, everyone's going to be different in terms of their preferences. But that's mine.
Good answer. Not going to catch him out tonight, guys, I'm afraid. I'm trying to drop some questions to phase him, but I'm not going to phase him. He's got his own podcast. He's not going to get phased. He's used to this the whole time. Anyway, so what about, I'm interested. So, okay, let's get to kind of, we can't get beat around the bush with COVID-19. When it comes to people widening, sports therapists in particular, obviously, widening their client base, I suppose there's always that attraction of trying to get more people. But then there's that fear of working with somebody who is maybe not elite, but somebody who's a bit more serious, somebody who's like a club runner very high up, thinking, oh, they're not going to see me. What kind of words of advice would you have for anybody in here or listening who wants to work with a higher category athlete, but have got kind of a little bit of fear. Have you got any bits of advice of how to approach them, how to contact them, what to do, what not to do?
Yeah, I think the first thing to try to be is just be the best that you can be, because that will naturally attract people by word of mouth. So, for example, in my practice, I don't do any form of external advertising whatsoever. All of my doing good things for people more often than not, and that word spreads over a period of time. So I think the first thing is just have a good knowledge base, have a good skill base, a good competence base, do the best that you can possibly do. But you mentioned the scope of practice there. It's just realizing what is your scope of practice, where maybe I can help people and where I maybe need to refer them on. This isn't my area of specialism. I maybe need to develop a network of people that, pardon me, I can refer to where needed. Or just maybe looking at different referral pathways that you can make if you get into the point where you've got somebody part of the way, but maybe you just need that little bit of extra, maybe expertise or strength in a certain area to be able to help you out to move them on to get the result that you want. Ultimately, if you're trying to do a good job for most people that you're seeing, then I think what you tend to find is those referrals happen quite organically. You don't need to maybe tell people how good you are type of situation. And it's equally having the confidence, you know, certainly have confidence in your own ability to do that job to your best of your ability. And I think that's probably the best piece of advice, because I think when you start to think about maybe getting anxiety or am I good enough, or like you say, imposter syndrome of working with this person, what you've got to realize with the elite sports people is that they're just people, they're just humans that to happen to be exceptionally good at what they do. But I remember, you know, at Hearts in particular, you're having conversations about what they're going to have for the tea. You know, I was very privileged to be one of the first people that one of the players told that his wife was pregnant, for example, or we're going to have another child. You know, so you're having these normal conversations with them, but they just do exceptionally good things on the pitch. But they don't actually want to be treated in any different way. They just want to be treat like normal human beings, but then obviously backing that up with you being pretty good at what you do.
So you mentioned it's true, you are quiet on the social media background, which is commendable. Do you think that's because that works for you, or do you think people maybe spend too much time trying to advertise on social media?
I think from an advertising perspective, well, I suppose across the board I'm quite quiet, because I don't like to get drawn into a lot of the BS that's on there, to be quite honest with you. There's a lot of, you know, a lot of ego and people trying to create negativity and arguments interprofessionally when they don't really need to be doing that, you know. So that's probably the prime reason that I don't get involved in too much online. I try to be quite positive, you know, if I've come across a good piece of research, retweet that. If there's something good that's going on, support that, say, check this out, you know. Try not to get involved too much down the negative side of things. As far as advertising goes, then I think you can align advertising and marketing to specific areas that you might want to work more in or are up and coming. For example, you know, if we take running, for example, if you start to align any awareness of what you can do in your clinic to specific events like the London Marathon, if and when it goes ahead again, things like that, you know, so maybe look in the calendar and try to align initiatives of how you might attract clients from specific sports at different points in the year. Start to do some education. One thing that's a key thread that helps a lot of people to attract attention to some of the services that they might provide is to provide some free education for people on a regular basis, whether that be, you know, like a newsletter, an infographic, anything really that draws people's attention that you can then hook them into your clinic, your branding, or the services that you're providing for people, that can be really quite useful as well. So I think the key thing around social, any form of social media, whether it's Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, is just to kind of try to use it positively, try to engage the type of person, the demographic that you're trying to see or want to align yourself to, given a specific sport or group of sports. And that will naturally bring a flow. Maybe not immediately. Somebody might see something. Marketing is an interesting thing, isn't it? When somebody takes the option straight away, or whether you sit in the back of their mind for 12 to 18 months and they just remember you when something comes up. You know, they might actually see something referenced to London Marathon. It clicks in, they've seen something before, and before you know it, they're a new patient referral. So marketing is quite complex in how it works. But if you have this constant presence, then what's the saying that people have to see something multiple times? I forget the actual number, but it's 15 to 17 times before they'll take action on it. So if you're continuously putting out information that's good quality and it's helpful for people and it's positive and it's not negative, then people are going to remember that in a positive way, and potentially it's going to lead to, you know, referrals or engagement or contact.
What's it been like? Obviously now a lot of, well, everything has got to follow a virtual consultation first of all, before you can actually justify them coming to the clinic. But how, with the non-sporting population, I think virtual consultations have taken off quite well. With people who are still competing, is there still as much room for virtual consultation?
Are you referring to more the elite standard athletes, there, competitive athletes, or?
Yeah, somebody who's actually probably more used to, maybe, I have this idea that the more professional they get, the more high performing they are, the less likely they are going to be able to work in an environment where they're on the end of the camera. They're probably more used to training sessions and being face to face and need that kind of attachment to actually focus.
Well, I would say that's probably, it's something that I've come across as an issue since COVID in spring, that I went down the line of starting to produce lots of educational content. I realized that I had a lot more time available to me. That's led to me releasing or launching the podcast as well. I had that opportunity to do that. But what I was realizing is there was a difficulty engaging people in online consultation. They just didn't really initially see the value in it. They associated coming to see a physiotherapist with, they come to clinic and we do hands-on things to them, and therefore they would prefer a face-to-face consultation. And initially that was really quite a struggle to try to engage people in the benefits of online consultation, because we've got to remember that patients are just so used to seeing people face-to-face in clinics. They just... So we've got to remember that when we offer people online consultation, it's just not, and particularly when they're paying for it versus being offered it through the NHS, there's an expectation of, if I'm paying some money to come and see you, I prefer to see you face to face rather than online, for example. And that's definitely something that I've come across throughout this COVID period. And it's actually been quite challenging, because I know the benefit of what I can give to people. I diversified my range of assessments now so that I can pretty much do, I'll be confident that I can do a pretty full assessment of somebody in their own home online and glean as much information almost as I could in clinic. There's certain exceptions to that, but I would be confident to at least try to manage somebody online much more often now. And the other thing that's happened as well is that I've developed much more of a hybrid format of assessment and follow-up. So I might initially see certain people in clinic, but then once I've seen them in clinic, made the diagnosis, for example, engaged them in a care pathway and suggested to them the possibility of online follow-up, they're much more in line with having that as a model of follow-up and review. So I think moving forward, it's definitely something that I will continue to offer to people as whatever their preference might be. And it also allows us to widen our net, doesn't it? Mm-hmm. I've consulted people from Dubai and Miami with regard to the golf side of things. I would have never done that before. So it's kind of widening the net, definitely. So I think from that perspective, we've got to see the opportunities. We've got to understand that maybe clients and patients and athletes don't quite understand the value of it yet. But I think in the second period of this lockdown, the longer these things are going on, people are starting to realize that it has to be part of the way that we manage things moving forward.
So you mentioned you've got different, like, assessing, you've reached the point where you feel you can assess people pretty much for everything with them at home. Does it make it more difficult if they're kind of stronger and more robust. And I mean, for somebody who's not an athlete, you can stand on one leg or try and get a little squat against the wall. But when they're kind of walking, mean kind of sporting machines, how are you going to test them at home?
It's difficult, Matt. You know, to be quite honest, that's one of the big things that I've seen as a challenge. If you're trying to manage an athlete, I mean, if I look at some of the athletes that I work with, there's one that I'm thinking of who's a competitive Olympic level javelin thrower. And he's fortunate enough that ahead of all of this, he had a full and normal gym setup at home, all of the max strength type of load that he'd ever need. So he's ahead of the game. He was always doing most of his training at home anyway. But the real challenge for this period has been how to load the athletes to a high enough level to maintain, because from, like you say, body weight perspective, we can do lots of good work there against bands and resistance. The difficulty people have had is getting weight into their home delivered, because obviously there's been a massive shortage nationwide of good gym equipment for people. So that's been an issue. So then it really, you have to understand how to manipulate variables. So we're looking at, well, how do we manipulate maybe time under tension, for example? How do we include isometric pause holds to really start to stimulate them in a similar way? We know it's not going to be the same, but how can we get them as close to what they would normally train as possible? And there's a lot of talk about flattening curves at the moment, isn't there, with reference to the virus? Well, from a loading perspective, we're trying to flatten the curve as well, because if there's this big drop off, and if you look at, you know, Tim Gabbett's work on stress yielding, acute chronic workload ratio, and just from a common sense perspective, we're seeing some issues as athletes re-engage back into their normal training pattern through not being able to load themselves specifically enough. We saw this in the German Bundesliga the first weekend that they went back. Their muscle injury rate was quadrupled, and that was with some pretty smart programming from their medical staff. So it's been a huge challenge. It continues to be even now, and we've just got to be creative, got to think around the problem rather than look at it.
Very good. Yeah, so chances are, I guess, if you are working with someone who is doing it for a living, they're probably going to have some more equipment in their own home, aren't they? They're going to have more weights. They might have their own gym.
That's been the surprising thing, you know. Many haven't.
Really? They used to just go down?
Yeah, they've got so used to attending either local high-performance gyms, or I've had golfers that haven't had a practice net in their back garden because they're just so used to going down the range, for example. So that's where the challenges have come. You would have expected people maybe to have more. We would have anticipated this difficulty getting access to equipment, but certainly had to think on our feet with a few clients, definitely.
And looking ahead, I mean, not to be too bleak, but this virus is probably going to be around probably for a good few months yet, maybe even up to a year. Things are going to be adjusted, and depending on the general public, will dip in and out, or people being silly and then sensible and silly and sensible. But is that something that athletes you work with are going to have to change and maybe consider being more able to train at home and, you know, sort a gym out at home and sort out like something they can do?
Yeah, 100%. And we've got ahead of that with a lot of the athletes that I'm working with, trying to set them up with home-based gyms, trying to get, again, it comes back to that higher load training that many of them have struggled with, having sufficient weight and load at home to train with, to train things like max strength and power, for example, having a space where they can do that training as well. You know, if we're expecting people to be throwing med balls around, for example, to work on rate of force development, they've got to have a safe and effective place to do that in. Otherwise they get shouted out by the other half for destroying the plaster work on the wall, for example, you know. So it's exactly. you're in a scenario where it's practicalities, really, trying to set people up to be in an opportunity to succeed rather than having issues and real problems and having to think on the fly with it, really. Certainly it's changed the landscape of how athletes are competing as well, because that's definitely changed moving forward. Subtly, so for example, with some of the golfers, they have to arrive at their practice schedule times at specific times on the course and the range, whereas previously they might do more, for example, because they have the flexibility to do so. And in doing that, that changes their loading profile quite significantly. So it's opening up all sort of nuance that we never really had to think about before. But if the net effect of that is that there's a drop in load on the athlete, we have to try and bump that up from somewhere to again shallow that curve, if we understand it like that. So again, that's been a little challenge, but again, something we're kind of working through and out the other side. But like you say, I think that's going to continue at least into the best part of spring into next year, where things might start to just look a little bit more stable with how the virus is looking.
We've got a few familiar names here just saying hi to you. I'm sure you spent a lot of time with Mike over the years. So Mike Grice is here. Thanks for joining us, Mike. Also, Sue here has agreed, saying, I totally agree with Andrew. I don't advertise on social media, don't have a website, as I get my clients word of mouth. This works for me. It takes quite a long time to build a therapy business. Certainly does. Gwanya has joined us. I thought you had enough after 2 weeks ago, Gwanya. Nice to see you. Thanks for joining us. And then Tom underneath has said, loving to hear about the remote work. The opportunity to do that is huge. I'm not sure how much people realize that yet. I think it is. I wonder whether sports therapists, I mean, no, it's the same for physios, isn't it? You've got to kind of, actually, I'm not sure for physios. Well, you know, for healthcare in general, you've got to prove that they need to come to see you face to face because it's essential to health. Yeah, which is kind of a really weird gray area. But if that person needs loading, which they can't get at home, and you in your place of work have got that loading to give to them and it's essential to their health, I wonder if there's a business there where the sports therapist should be setting up like a little mini gym in their practice, because then in theory, each time, if that's essential to the person's health, doing that exercise, you've got a nice little repeat business going until maybe April, May, June.
Yeah,
or am I recommending something that's totally bad?
No. I think the Nuffield gym and therapists, they're working together with regard to that, you know, because most of the clinics have a gym within them. I think you have to be, as far as I understand it, under direct care of a therapist to be able to access the gym facility. But that's still allowing people, as you say, to maintain some degree of load as part of their condition and recovery or rehabilitation. For example, I've had two of my athletes, my MMA fighters, recently have ACL reconstructions, both paid for that privately. So that's between £7,000 and £10,000, for example. So they need rehabilitation. They need access to equipment to be able to load effectively. And they're both professional fighters. So I think from that perspective, as long as you can justify it, reasonable measures are in place and the requirement for that access to gym facilities, 100%, you know, I think that that's a sensible way to look at things, actually, Matt.
I think it's a business day. I'm hoping some people listening to this or in the on the live show tonight are thinking about that. You'd have to invest a little bit in some equipment, and it might take a while to get it delivered, because I know there's, like you say, there's a huge shortage of weight in general and delivery problems. But yeah, definitely something sports therapists could get involved in. Just to remind you guys, you've got a chance here tonight. I mean, it'd be easy to say what sports, Andrew, are you not involved in? I don't think I saw badminton there, maybe.
No, tiddlywinks and bowls.
Tiddlywinks kind of moved on. But yeah, if anyone there is interested in working with like golf, tennis, MMA, athletics, football, then now's the chance to ask a question about how to work with these people, how to network, because this man has done it and continues to do it all. Timothy Grigg is making a, hey Timothy, how are you doing? The Tottenham documentary showed a good insight into training during COVID. Main issue was recreating load and intensity of training, but at home. Yeah, big challenge.
It's a fascinating documentary, actually. I've watched that recently, just finished watching it. And it was interesting because obviously you recollect your time working in professional football, but there were some points where there was three and four professionals, health professionals around one player. And you're thinking, why is there three and four people trying to consult one player at any one time? Surely there should just be one person. And it was very specific players. I won't mention who they are, but it was quite clear that they were the important players in the squad and therefore maybe attracted a little bit more attention from the medical team. But it's, as you say, fly on the wall documentary and very, very insightful. The thing that made me laugh was the walk that you have as a lead therapist. You have to discuss every morning which players are injured and take that sheet to the manager. So you're basically telling your manager who he can't have for training that particular day. It's never a popular conversation. And Jeff Thomas, who's the physio there, was, you know, he's a nice guy and great at his job, but you just get that feeling that he's walking into the lion's den almost, you know, telling Jose Mourinho which players he can't have for the day. It's a very difficult conversation sometimes to have.
Becky's got a question here, and I'll read it out for people listening on the podcast as well. Have you found that most athletes are adapting and overcoming the obstacles faced with COVID in respect to their training and or rehab? Question. Or do you feel that being without their medical team and peers around them, that it's having a detrimental effect to their physical and mental health?
It's I think COVID's been challenging in terms of access to care. I think that what we're seeing with, and had this discussion with James Hull actually, and with reference to the longer COVID symptoms, they're quite interesting because there's quite a broad range of things that people are getting over the initial viral load and recovering from that initially, but then having these more long-term symptoms that seem to be more persistent. And they seem to be pretty, you know, things like fatigue, lack of energy, some cardiovascular issues that I think they're noticing that there's some issues around pulmonary embolism that probably they weren't expecting that are causing breathlessness and things like that. So I think from that perspective, it's throwing up some unique challenges. Athletes not having access to their medical team, absolutely, because or their multidisciplinary team around them, where those pathways have been disrupted. Obviously, we've been trying to be as flexible because they go about things often in quite repetitious ways, and they like those things to be in place over time. So anything that disrupts that can be quite challenging for them, especially when they're trying to push themselves at the elite level. So again, it comes back to trying to look at solutions for the athletes rather than the problems that present themselves, really, and being adaptable and flexible as a therapist and working as part of that team, either the way in which you communicate back to the athlete or the way in which the communication pathway revolves around that team of people working with them.
Sorry, a little bit of interruption. Can you go and work? Thank you. Have you go away? Thank you. There you go. Happens. Good question, Becky. I'm interested in, because you work with, so you say athletes. I've always had to do, we talked about this a little bit off air, to really help these people to understand what they're going through. I don't know whether it's vital, but how important is it that you've actually played their sport and be involved? Maybe not obviously the level they're at, but understand, because there are differences between different sports, the hours they play, the type of training they do, the demand, the fitness demands, the psychological demands. I mean, you've managed to succeed in across a massive spectrum of sports. I've always just stuck with runners and paid certain prices for it, although I've enjoyed lots of things with it as well. But is there, well, do you need, have you played all the sports with the people you play with? Are you a good golfer? Are you a good tennis player? Are you a good footballer? Does that help?
No, I think I'm bang average a lot of sports. I think the key thing is that no, you don't need to have played that sport. Absolutely. I think that if we use football as a reference, actually some of the best managers, football manager, Arsene Wenger, Jose Mourinho, they were average players, but they're exceptional coaches. I think it's more about of an understanding. If you're working with a given sport, you need to understand what the demands and requirements of that sport are. And you need to understand something about the biomechanics of it. And when you've worked in a sport for a particular period of time, there's a certain language that is specific to that sport. So, you know, when you listen to footballers speak, rugby players speak, there's certain words that they use, an inclination, a tone or a description to a game or a training setup that you'll understand. And for example, when you work in football, you sit in on many team tactics talks of where the coaches are describing what this player might do in this situation. So you begin to gain an understanding of that sport technically as well, the longer you're exposed to it. So I think the key thing really is, no, you don't have to have been a decent level sports person at that given sport that you're working in, but you need to understand the language, the biomechanics, the loading, the requirements. If you've clearly got no understanding of what that athlete, that person needs to do, and this is both in the elite and non-elite environments, you're really going to struggle to provide the top level quality service that we're trying to aim for, really. So take some time, you know, spend some time. For golf, for example, when I first started working in golf, I just went down local ranges with PGA pros and got to know them, stood on the range, watch how they coach, same with football. When we weren't so busy, I used to go out onto the pitches and just spend some time with the coaches and watch how they coach and how the players interact with them. You've got to get the understanding of the world in which these athletes live in. Absolutely. The tennis players, exactly the same. We're very, very fortunate to have some great tennis coaches at Loughborough. And like I say, Matt now works with Andy Murray. So just, you know, learn as much as you can from everybody that you're surrounded with. That's one key piece of information, actually, that I probably should stress to people. You know, just be a sponge. When you work in these environments, try to be a sponge and learn as many different things out of your profession as you possibly can. You know, spend time with S&C guys, the coaches, the psych, the medics, and just have an interest, really. And from that, you start to put together this knowledge that then you can use to help people.
I guess it's a bit like learning a language. Once you've managed to work with a couple of sports or two or three sports, and you've managed to take in these things and work out the way of getting involved with it, then the fourth sport and the fifth sport are a little bit easier. So you've already got those mechanisms in place, haven't you, to actually learn how to work with the athletes?
Well, that's probably a great point with MMA. You know, I've been working in MMA for around about 7 or 8 years now. And before that, I did judo as a kid, but I had zero experience in MMA, none whatsoever. I got asked to be involved with an up-and-coming professional fighter, started to watch UFC. But then when you start to break down lots of movement patterns, and particularly with this fighter, didn't have a particularly strong base, a good training age with his S&C, you start to look at how somebody maybe strikes, for example. And there's a lot of similarities with how somebody might hit biomechanically. So you start to evolve your knowledge of cross-body patterning, rate of force development, max strength training, and you start to apply it to that sport. Because unless you're working with the top guys, the UFC fighters, and you're working at the UFC Performance Institute, which is unlikely, in their guys at the top of their field, you're offering a level of expertise and knowledge that fighter doesn't currently have, and you're helping them in some way. But by the time I was coming to MMA, I probably already had, you know, 15 years of working with various sports under my belt. So I think once you get to that time scale of having worked with sports for a period of time, I think you have quite a diverse, probably expert level of knowledge where you can just start to plug that into different situations and then top up the bits that you feel need further development. In my case, it was about, like we were talking off camera, understanding the complexities of things like jiu-jitsu and some of the movements that they make, and understanding the torque. You know, I didn't know what shrimping was before I got involved in MMA, and it's a very specific movement that an MMA fighter trains and has to make. You know, it's a defensive tactic, but it's something they're using training all of the time. So if you don't know what that is, then you don't understand the movements, you don't understand the biomechanics, and therefore you can't align the training to it. So it's probably quite a good example of what we were just talking about.
Very good. Who's the fighter? No, you can't tell me. I don't know what his future is like. Did he get better? Did he do well?
Very good. Yeah, he fights on Bellator at the moment.
Fantastic. Yeah. I've tried to watch the fights without the audience. I'm sorry, I can't get into it. It's really bad. Even like top names I'm seeing, it's very tricky.
I don't know whether you picked it up, Matt, but what you do understand is the intensity of the striking, because you hear it.
Oh, I think that's what puts me off a little bit.
you don't normally hear it, you know, because of the crowd. But obviously when they're not there, you just begin to understand. And again, with rugby, for example, if you're up close to a contact, you begin to understand some of these loading requirements. You also therefore begin to understand that a piece of clinic band isn't going to cut the mustard, you know. So I think from that perspective, it allows you to align what you need to do. Because one of the points that I was probably going to make there is that when you're working with these guys, you need to give them a safety valve. So where they need to operate is way above actually what they need and require in training and in competition. And that's always where you're trying to get them to, whether it's return them back from injury, or you're with Tim, for example, we're trying to improve his strength and conditioning profile so that he's got a better level of athletic performance. If you can try and get them just that 10, 15, 20% more than what they actually need, then you've given them that safety valve that they can operate in.
You've hit a spot there with the talking, all talk of sponge. M. Turner said, that's what I love about my job. That's lovely to hear straight away. If you're in a profession where you say, that's what I love about my job, then
you're in the right occupation.
Exactly. Having the time in a session to be able to be a sponge. It's amazing how many clients say, nobody has ever asked me that. They feel listened to. I learn, win, win. Perfect. Very nice, Em. So, yeah, you mentioned the podcast. You on, when did that start? That started in COVID, did it? You thought I've got
it
some did, time
yeah.
There.
It gave me something I'd had in my mind to try and get off the ground, again, related to education and thank you very much. Just helping people to understand more about sports performance in particular. What I wanted to have as the concept behind it was speak to people who are world leaders in their field and try and distill that information down into ways in which we can help the athletes ourselves from a health and fitness professional perspective, but also a competitive athlete, you know, weekend warrior, somebody who's really enthused about their sport could listen to that and think, okay, well, yeah, I can apply that to my sport. Even though I'm not elite, I can learn from the elite. So that was the concept and the kind of thought process behind it. Had a bit more time to get it off the ground. So I cracked on and actually COVID presented a great opportunity. Lots of the people that I wanted to speak to were actually at home because they were working from distance and remotely. Everyone's been just fantastically generous. You know, the people that I've approached and had on the show, they're world leaders in their field and, you know, their time is valuable. So it's been fantastic. I'm learning as much as about interviewing technique and getting the thing that you understand about interviewing people, and you probably understand this better than most, is that you ask questions at certain times to get extra little bits of information from people, and you develop that as a skill over time. And that's something that I've been learning now for a period of time. But yeah, it's been fantastic. I'm learning lots, and more importantly, I'm thoroughly enjoying it. Every person I'm speaking to has just got a different thread. Tomorrow morning, for example, I'm interviewing Nick Winkelmann, and delighted to have him on the podcast. He's a world leader in coaching. So if we can get some great information from Nick on the podcast, then that's going to be helpful for people moving forward as well. So yeah, we just enter into the third series of it this Friday. So yeah, it's been great.
It's a great show. And there's a really great selection there as well. And it's lovely that it is across the board. It's sports as opposed to the running podcast. There are some excellent running podcasts out there, but this is like encapsulates everything, which allows you to stand back a little bit and have a look at the similarities rather than just, yeah, sectioning stuff out. It's good. Recommend it, people. Just get a little splash there. 20 episodes for you to catch up with. Look at that. There's some great reading and listening for you.
Yeah, I'll just give another quick shameless plug. I've just agreed to do another podcast as well. That's through the Health Development Performance Network, the HDPN, with James Muir and the team. And that's going to be more of a clinically focused podcast. So that's going to be more therapy biased. Again, sports focused, but clinician development type stuff. So that's going to be a nice contrast to the sports performance show. This one's going to be a little bit more clinically focused, so that'd be useful for people coming up in the next
Fantastic.
Couple of months.
When's
really.
That come? What's that going to be called?
It's the HDPN podcast powered by the Sports Performance Show. It's a bit of a mouthful, but it's just it representing is, the two the two podcasts working together. You know, we were chatting about it and just felt there was some common ground there. I massively respect James. He's a hugely experienced physiotherapist, works across lots of different areas. So I was delighted to get involved, and that's going to be launching over the next couple of months.
Fantastic. And if people are interested on your website, then let's give that a little splash there as well. Recover, prevent, perform. And then that's broken down at the different stages. I love seeing people's websites and how you've got that chance, that portal to explain what you do. And I like the way you've done yours, and you're doing virtual consultations. So there's information there if people are interested in hearing a little bit more about Andrew and active therapy. And if people want to kind of, I mean, you're not really on social media that much, but if people do want to kind of converse with you, what's the best way? Is it via your website?
Yeah, happy for people to drop me a message on Twitter, which is ActiveTherapy1, I think it is. Instagram is Active_Therapy. Facebook, there's an Active Therapy page on there as well. Or if people want to drop me an email, Andrew@active-therapy.com. Then happy to discuss anything really. If anyone wants any advice that I can give them or point them in the right direction or help them out in any way, more than happy to do that. If you can usually give me about 24-48 hours to get back to you, then I'll always come back to you. You know, if you send me a message, it's no problem at all.
Fantastic. That's good to know. There's a few questions in here I've had time to answer tonight, but as always, I'll try to encourage our guests to dip in there either later tonight or tomorrow at some point and clear some things up. So you can keep putting questions in there for Andrew. And I, if he can't get here, then I'll copy and paste and send it on an email. So we will answer it. So apologies if we haven't met answers for you. Right then, Andrew, thank you so much for your time. There's a lot, awful lot in there, which I hope will encourage people to see the similarities between working with non-sporting and sporting, and also break down some of those walls traditionally we put up when it thinks, oh, I can't work in those. That's way too elite for me. I can't offer them and that sort of stuff. But there's definitely a lot you can do if you believe in yourself, and you are living proof of that with everything you've achieved. So thank you very much. What it's a bit weird, isn't it? The rest of the year, we don't know what's going on, but have you got, you mentioned the podcast, anything else coming up for you?
Got the podcast, which is taking up a lot of my time at the moment, just in terms of editing, recording and getting new guests on that. When the European tour gets going again, I'm hoping to, we've had a really successful year with a player that I work with, Aaron Rye. He won the Scottish Open this year, which is a Rolex series. So he's currently in the top 10, race to Dubai, and he's picked up some decent amount of money this year for winning the Scottish. I think he won €945,000, which is a decent sum of money for him, which is fantastic. It's great. I've been working with Aaron for, you know, 15 years, 10 years, sorry, not 15 years. So we're all delighted for him as a team of people are around him that are working with him. So hope to spend a little bit more time, maybe looking at some of the tour events with him next year. Continue to develop the practice. I'm developing a bit more of a holistic athlete wellness service at the moment. So we're looking at things like a holistic one-stop shop for athletes where we can get them tested with bloods, have a look at some nutrition that are linking to a qualified sports nutritionist with as well, looking at strength and conditioning with them, testing injury risk mitigation. So basically for athletes can come in, it's a one-stop shop, and then we deal with most things that we can, and those that we can't, we'll refer out to our network of specialists. So yeah, looking forward to trying to launch that over the next couple of months, and some nice time off at Christmas with the family, I think. Probably. Hopefully. Like yourself, Matt.
Exactly, when Boris will suddenly say it's okay for everyone to mix up for 5 days and just chill out. This is bound to happen. Yeah. Stuff. I also enjoy the way I was teaching the other day some sports therapists and kind of celebrating the fact that we can now say the word holistic without insinuating we're going to light some joss sticks and kind of play some well music. It's coming back in now with the whole BPS and everything. Holistic is actually a healthy, nice word you can use now. Whereas I remember, yeah, like maybe 10 years ago, someone said, oh no, I'm quite holistic. It was like, oh, here we go, hug a tree, you know. But
I think one of the key pieces word that we've already discussed is just people probably dropping the labels of what they are. Obviously, it relates to some professional qualifications, but just be the best therapist that you can be, irrespective of whether you're physio, osteo, chiro, sports therapist, whoever, really. Just provide the best level of quality services that you can, and the rest will take care of itself, really.
Beautiful. Look at that. If that's not a point to take home from this, then I don't know what is. Brilliant. All right, Andrew, what I'm going to do is I'm just going to put you down in the lobby whilst I say goodbye to these people. And then I'll come down and say thank you personally. Okay.
Pleasure, guys.
Thanks very much again for joining us. No Andrew problem, Corker, everybody. All right, there we go. So I've done so much. I mean, it is 23 years, but obviously that's a long time. But when you look at the CV of the opportunity seen and what he's achieved with athletes, still working with athletes after 10, 15 years, amazing bloke, loads of experience there. So take him up, definitely take him up on his offer. It's particularly if you're interested in like the golf or the tennis or the football. Definitely a lot of information there, worth contacting him for some advice and help. So there we go. Right, people, before I let you go, just a little shout out from my own neck of the woods. Runners Collect is drumming up lots of people. There's about nearly 600 now. Once it gets to 1,000, then I'll, if you're not aware, I've done two seasons of talking to therapists, and there's 52 episodes there of world-class people, including Dr. Ben O'Neig. We've got everyone's in, the Laymans, the Bartolds, the everyone you can think of I've had as a guest. So this episode of One Shot Live is going to be talking to actual runners. I'm giving it a rest for the therapist. I need to be more confident that what I've got to say is actually reaching the runners and not just therapists. So once we get to 1,000 runners collective, then we'll start weekly shows with actual runners, almost like online consultations, but hanging it all out for everyone to see and everyone to talk about and taking the mystery out of it. So the idea is it is becoming a Facebook group. I am letting therapists in there as long as therapists bring three runners in a month. And the idea for that is I want it to be a hub where therapists, imagine you've had a virtual consultation and you've kind of told the person all about this. Okay, I know your knee's hurting, but it doesn't mean there's all that pain is because there's something really serious with your knee. There's other factors. And then you finish your 45 minutes. It's like, what are they going to do for this week? The idea is I'm trying to provide a hub where you can send your runners to the Runners Collective and it's going to build on what you've taught them. No one's going to poach them. It's just going to make your job easier because the idea is they'll be in a healthy runners forum instead of going back to their 24,000 community where they'll say, oh, try this bit of tape. It's lovely, especially the red one because it's got more stretch in it. You know, the sort of thing which keeps runners injured, basically. So I encourage you. I don't want it full of therapists, but out of the 600 members, I think there's about 50 therapists now. And then I have the great job at the end of the month of getting rid of therapists who haven't brought runners along, which I'm really looking forward to. That's going to make me feel very powerful. But it's all for a good cause. So there you go. And also, if you haven't caught up with it yet, if you didn't manage to get to the conference, then that is all online now, therapistlearning.com. All the recordings there from 2 days, including the lunch chats for an hour with, like I was saying before, Greg Lehman, JF Escoulier, and Kevin Maggs from the Running Clinic were there chatting it out. And we had Alex Hutchinson in, Sweat Science. We had Izzy Moore was in. We had, well, as the guests as well. I mean, Matt Fitzgerald was the highlight for me, somebody I've read for 15 years, and having him there talking about his experiences was amazing. So yeah, if you haven't yet and you're looking for some CBD, look no further, guys. It's here. There is a charge because you missed the ticket, but it's not a lot if you just want access for a month. Then you can get 2 days worth of, I'm biased, but I think it was pretty good running talk. So there we go. I don't think I've got any other housekeeping to do. Gary mentioned earlier on, just to make sure you're aware, there is currently a members prize draw in the open group, the chance to win one of 10 virtual courses or places on a talk with Adam Meekins and Ben Cormack. Ah, yes. So Anna Maria. So yeah, the Massage Collective have managed to get Adam and Ben together. And for course they're delivering. So there's some news about that. STA are offering some free places. So make sure you do look in the open group for what you've got to do to win those. Right, folks, thanks very much for joining me once again. Thank you to my guest, Andrew Caldwell. If you're listening to the podcast and you have enjoyed it, then show your love by actually leaving a rating and a review. It makes all the difference. It needs to be on Apple or iTunes. They're the ones which make the big difference. We're only doing this to get what we consider to be good news out there. So we need your help really to share it. So please, please, please do that. We will be back same time next week, 8 o'clock on a Tuesday with another guest, with another subject from the world of soft tissue therapy. Remember, you're welcome to join us even if you're not a Sports Therapy Association member. Doesn't matter. We're all therapists. We're all working together, especially in these weird, wacky COVID-19 times. Yeah, like I say, we're dropping the tags and just we'll trying to learn better ways to look after people. That's what it's all about. Okay, guys, take care, and we'll see you this time next week. Bye-bye.
You're listening to the Sports Therapy Association podcast. Let's talk about it.